Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, new year, new you, and all that jazz. Simon gives us his essential steps to getting your finances on a sound footing as we move forward in 2026. Also today, it's been bad news for a while for pubs. Could they get a last-minute business rate reprieve, though? Which would mean Labour politicians can actually be allowed back into their local boozers. Better news for banks. Lloyd's share price hits its highest since the financial crash. So is the industry set for another bumper year? Speaking of Lloyd's, it's launched its best ever current account switching bonus, while HSBC is offering a whopping £750 to entice new Premier Bank account customers. So is it time to move? And how to turn your house into a zero bills home? And importantly, how much would it cost to do so? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. With the new year here and your New Year's resolutions confirmed, now it's time to take control of your financial future with support from Charles Stanley Direct's Financial Coaching. Led by This Is Money regular Lisa Kaplan, Financial Coaching gives you access to a real expert who can help you make sense of your 2026 financial plans. Book your free 15-minute call today at charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, make 2026 the year you take control of your financial future. Remember, investment involves risk. Now back to the show. Right, we're talking about New Year's, whether you call it a New Year's resolution, an intention, or you just want to put yourself on a better financial footing regardless of the day or the month, Simon has kindly pulled together his seven essential steps. And Simon, I like this quote, by the way, that you said in the piece. The reality is that while I may know more now, I used to be a lot better at managing my money when I had less of it. And it got me thinking, Simon, because yes, that's true for me too. But anyway, Lee, I will get your tips as well, if that's all right, so you can have some time to think about them while Simon talks. So Simon, tell us more. Why did you pull together your seven essential tips? Why not eight? Could you not think of eight?
Well, you've got to settle on a number, haven't
you? That's true. Yeah.
And you don't want it to be too few, and you don't want it to be too many. We've all been there when you started to write the my 100 tips and realised you may have bitten off more than you can chew. Sometimes even if you just go for 12, it's too much. Mm. You go for three, it's not enough. You know, you got to hit a number. So, I just thought of, it was some things that I think are the foundations for your finances, the basic stuff, the essentials, the things that mean you are then on a sound footing before you can go on and do some other stuff. Forgive me, listeners, if this sounds a bit basic, but these are the things I think you just need nailed, and then you can go, right, okay, I can move on a step. So before I start talking and explaining them, I will give you a comment from one of our readers who said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Lambert, but this is really a case of stating the bleeding obvious. If anyone read this plan and went, wow, what good ideas, then I'm in despair of the common sense in this country. Possibly the idea of a power of attorney may be something the average person hasn't thought of, spoiler alert. But really, knowing where the money goes and trying to have some savings is so obvious that surely the vast majority are doing it already. Quite patronising, really. So apologies to anybody that I'm about to patronise, but I'm going to patronise you now. So there you go.
All right, then.
So back to your point, actually, your original question is that I used to be a lot better at managing my money when I had less of it. This is something that I think is probably a problem for lots of people, is when you're in your 20s, you have more time on your hands. You won't feel like you have more time on your hands, to be clear, but you do have more time on your hands. You're less busy with work. You're less busy with family stuff. It's easier to be on top of your bills, your budget, all those other things that I need to do something, and then you actually do it. And this is especially true if you're one of these people who suffers from a procrastination problem. I am a high-functioning procrastinator, okay? I have a real problem with this. And the enemy of my intentions is procrastination and also a lack of time and the belief that I can create time and I'm possibly over ambitious with the amount of things that I intend to do. So I end up with lots of things I intend to do and lots of things that I don't do. So these are the things that I think you need to get done. I'll go through them quite quickly. Get a grip on your household budget. I've said it before, budgeting sounds immensely dull, but it is the essential first step to feeling more in control of your finances and ultimately getting richer. Because most people, I would say, have a pretty good idea of exactly how much money they have coming in every month. If you are an employee and you have a salary coming in every month, you can probably tell someone to within about £100 what your post-tax paycheck amount is. Obviously, if you're self-employed, Geordie, for example, it's a bit harder. You might have an idea of how much you should have coming in every month, but whether people are going to pay you that is another matter. And also, you know, your work ebbs and flows. But most people will know pretty much how much they've got coming in. How much is going out? Well, they might have a good idea of that as well. But where it actually goes is often a mystery to most people. And it is, I think, worth sitting down at least once a year, getting your bank statements. You could just sit and look at them on your phone with a pen and a piece of paper. You can do it however you want, but sort of working out where it all goes. The essential spending, that's what you need to know. The stuff that you absolutely have to spend your money on. Then the regular discretionary spending, you know, the bits where you could maybe cut back a bit, but this is stuff that you are going to be spending every month. Don't be under any illusions that you're not going to eat or ever go out again. And then the proper kind of discretionary stuff on top of that, I would say. Then you know what's coming in, what's going out, and how much you can save or invest. Checking your bills. Once you've done your budgeting, you then know how much you're spending on things like broadband, TV, energy, insurance, and stuff. And you can look at whether you can save money on them. You know, fixing your energy bills. Switching insurance, mobile phone contracts are a prime example of things you could be overpaying for, and some other stuff that you might just be paying for and not using. So have a look at that. Sorting debts. We talk about saving, we talk about investing, but really, before you do any of that, you need to get on top of debts if you have them. And if you have high interest debts, then you need to pay them off as soon as you possibly can. You probably can't pay them off immediately, which is why you have high interest debts. If you're just choosing to have high interest debts that you could pay off immediately, don't do that. That's not a good move. But this could be something like shifting it onto a 0% balance transfer card. It could be something like consolidating into a personal loan. It could be some other way of clearing that debt. Set yourself a time period, make it achievable, commit to it, automate it where you can. It requires perseverance. It is a long game. It could take more than a year. But should be a priority. A rainy day fund, even just having £1,000 in a rainy day fund, makes a huge difference between if something bad happens, whether they end up falling into financial difficulty that lasts for years or they don't. So we talk about needing 3 to 6 months of spending in a rainy day fund, but that's your essential spending. It's from post-tax income. It's not 3 to 6 months of your pre-tax wages, which to most people will sound like a mentally large amount. If you haven't got an emergency pot, don't just go stick your head in the sand, start saving one. Even if you start small, just having some of that there will help you. Saving into a pension. If you're employed, you should have been auto-enrolled into a pension. If you didn't auto-enroll into that, if you opted out, for example, or you've been employed since before that, then get yourself auto-enrolled. Make sure that you are in the most generous pension scheme that your workplace potentially offers, because this is a tip for people. You may not have been auto-enrolled into the good scheme that your company offers. You might have just been auto-enrolled into the standard auto-enrollment scheme, because I don't think they are allowed to auto-enroll you into the better scheme. You have to opt to do that. So check that you're in it, and check that you're paying as much into your pension as you can to make the most from your employer's contributions. If you're self-employed, it's on you. You need to save into a pension yourself. Open a SIP, do it. Don't put it off. Get a will. Again, procrastination. Georgie's smiling here. This is something I didn't do for way longer than I should have done it. If you have children, financial dependents, long-term partner, you need a will. Otherwise, if you die, the intestacy rules decide where your money and your assets go, and that might not be where you want it to go, and you might leave those people I just mentioned somewhat in the lurch. Again, I had kids for quite a few years before I did my will. Once I'd finally done it, it was great because now I've got a will and it's sorted. So do that. And then finally, lasting power of attorney, the thing that the spoiler alert was about. Lasting power of attorney is something that we think of old people needing. And it's the classic kind of you get someone in their 60s, 70s, 80s to do it because if they're incapacitated, it allows someone else to act for them, either financially or on health matters. And there's two different types of lasting power of attorney, one for money and property, one for health matters. This is obviously a financial podcast, so we're going to focus on the financial one, but the health one's important too. But this lets you appoint a trusted person to take control of your affairs if you are unable to do so. So that could be through illness, accident, or another event that incapacitates you. Now, I think everyone should have one of these. Certainly, everyone who was on the list before that I mentioned about wills. If you've got a financial dependent, a long-term partner, children, then you need a lasting power of attorney. Because if you think about it, you've got a will in case you die, like to help those people out, but it's probably statistically more likely if you're younger that you could end up in a terrible accident that incapacitates you than actually kills you. And is your family going to be able to get at the money that they need or make the financial decisions they need, deal with the mortgage, deal with something to do with the property, if something really bad happens to you and you're lying in that hospital bed? If everything isn't in joint names and your partner's able to access that, you need a lasting power of attorney. You can do this yourself at gov.uk /power hyphen of hyphen attorney. And there's guides to all of this stuff. There's links in my column to all of this stuff on the website. So just go to thisismoney.co.uk, look up the column, and you'll basically find the helpful advice that will enable you to act on these seven steps. And my final point on these seven steps is, right, you could theoretically knock these all off in a month, like as in either doing them or getting started on them. Clearly, you can't clear your debts in a month or build a rainy day fund in a month, but you could get started on it. So do it before the end of January.
Thank you very much, Simon. I can see from the person's perspective that, bar the power of attorney, that was a bit of a surprise for me, but I agree with you 100%. A lot of those things are, especially listeners to this show, will be very aware of what to do. The problem is, lots of us don't do it. This is where I absolutely disagree with the gentleman. And I do think it is a lot harder when we're older. We have less time, we have more responsibilities. It's not just us, but also, certainly, I didn't have as much money in my 20s. So I had to think about it a lot more. And then you get lifestyle creep when you're older, and we've spoken about that before. So the thing that I would add, and I've been jotting down, Simon, and this is something that slightly annoys me about finance, is that it's almost this one size fits all. If anyone has a problem with money, it's clearly because they're in debt. It's not. I mean, it might be that you're incredibly tight and it's ruining your chance of having any fun in life. There's lots of different reasons why people have an issue with money. So the first thing I said is write lists. And then I wrote a list. I'm a big list writer. Like when we spoke earlier, do we have resolutions or do we have intentions? Well, it depends on the type of person you are and what works for you. So figure out what works for you. Be positive. I'm a big fan of things like downloading banking apps. Having notifications come up on your phone when you spend money just engages your brain a little bit more with your bank and with your finances. Set up direct debits. Know yourself. If you're someone who's pretty lazy, who procrastinates, make it easy. Cut out the friction for yourself. And I've also written here, think about death. Famously, my other half at Christmas gave me a present. It was a book that said, "Now it's your problem," where I can fill in all the things about my death that I want to do. I mean, that's how much I talk about it, as you know, and as people to the podcast know, because I was badgering you for feels like years, Simon, to get a will. So that's what I would do, basically. And then I would read, I would listen, I would watch, I would immerse myself in finance. And the greatest thing I could ever say to people is have perspective. Think about where you were last year. Think about where you were the year before. If you've moved forward, great, let it motivate you. If you're not where you are, change it. Anyway, Lee, what are your tips?
Cool. Where am I going to get any tips in from you two's absolute kind of like,
Sorry, mate.
mega
I was off
buddy?
on one there.
I mean, yeah, I don't know what else I can add to that. I mean, a few things I would say is, as Simon touched on, you just got to get on with it. And one thing that I've definitely found helps, for our household budgeting is having a January audit where it's boring, wife hates me for it, but we sit down for a little while, we look at how investment pots have grown, how savings pots have grown, what's left on the mortgage. I call it the sort of like finances MOT in the house, just to see where we're at and making sure we know we're on top of what's where. And I just find that quite a useful experience. And the other thing about budgeting is, and you won't be shocked to hear that, and you was touched on it there about, keeping on touch with notifications. I don't have those notifications on my phone because the last thing I want is more notifications on my phone about anything. So I do budget quite strongly with cash. Always have done, probably always will do. And there was data out recently suggesting that cash use is holding pretty firm last year, and actually it pinpointed Essex and East Anglia, which made me laugh quite a bit, as places where cash use is still quite strong. And I still withdraw a couple of £100 on payday. I stick it in my wallet, and it's for my kind of like knowing that I'm not just like mindlessly tapping. But of course it gets more and more difficult each year because not everywhere accepts cash, and especially for things like buying a coffee, it's for quite typically, especially the big chains, that just don't accept cash anymore. But I find that helps. And then a couple of other things, I think, well, again, my wife hates me for this, but I'm just going to tell you anyway.
Never change, Lee. Never
This
change.
is changing into more like money saving, but the most important thing in the kitchen is the scales. I weigh out everything that I cook, so pasta, rice, everything, so there's zero waste and I don't overeat. And I reckon that's, I couldn't put a number on it, but I reckon that saves us quite a lot of money over the course of the year. And my last tip's going to be, if you are looking to build that £1,000 pot and you're struggling to find the kind of money to be able to do that, buy and sell your way into making it. Make it a little money making hobby. Try and make £100 a month by going into a charity shop, finding something and flipping it for some cash, or a car boot sale, or whatever your poison of choice is. It's actually easier than you think, and it becomes quite addictive, and it's quite a good way to build up a pot of cash.
Please write an article, Lee. Please do some sort of scientific research about how much you think you have saved. You can just do it over a month, then we can extrapolate it like every good research
Fine.
article does.
Fine by
Yeah.
me.
I have two more points to this. One, Lee, when you're doing your calculations, often I overcook so that I save it for the next day. Therefore, I do not have to use the same amount of energy, you see.
I
Oh,
still do
yeah?
that. I still
You
measure
still
out
do that?
for the next day as
Oh,
well.
right.
I'll
Okay.
cook enough
Right.
rice
Right.
for a portion for that night and a portion for the next night.
Right.
No, otherwise you're wasting money. You've turned it on the gas
Yeah.
and again.
Big oversight there by me. I should have known that you would know that. Forgive me, Lee. The other thing that I've, going back to the point I made about some people are overspenders, some people are underspenders. Whatever you spend your money on, think about what gives you value. That's all I'll say.
I think that's really important because you don't want to have a completely joyless life where you're trying not to spend any money whatsoever. Or you could do that if you wanted to, but for most people, that isn't what they want to do. Personally, that's not what I want to do. But just you make sure what you spend your money on counts. That's
Yeah.
the important thing to me, is getting the best for the money that I'm spending.
Let's put this to one side for now. Any ideas? Let us know. Now, could the government be about to perform another U-turn? Pub owners are warning that a steep rise in costs that are coming their way in April, with several changes all landing at once, for many locals could be the final straw. Now, the biggest issue is changes to business rates. It seems that ministers agree, and so the Treasury is reportedly putting together a pub-specific package to help out. But isn't the whole system ripe for change? Simon, before we dig into the details of the pubs, what are business rates and what's changing?
Right. So business rates are essentially the property tax that businesses pay. It's what they pay instead of council tax. And there's two elements to it. There is the rateable value of their property, and then there is a multiplier. The rateable value of the property is decided by the valuations office, and it's revised every so often. And then, based on that rateable value, and the type of business they are, they have a multiplier, which is measured in pence, and you times that by the rateable value. So, under the current system, there is two sets of businesses, premises effectively. The multiplier depends on whether you are judged to be a small business or not. And the level for being a small business is below £51,000. Above that, you pay the standard rate of business rates. But also, under the new system, there's going to be higher business rates for businesses with a rateable value of more than £500,000. These define the two multipliers. So you've got the small business multiplier, which is currently 49p, and the standard multiplier, which is 55.5p. That's for the above £500,000 properties. And you take your rateable value, which, for example, for my local pub, I looked this up yesterday. You can actually look this up yourself. For the April 2023 rateable value, it was £29,000. So they would take £29,000 and they would times it by the small business multiplier, which is 49p. That's changing. And what is going to happen instead is that there are going to be different multipliers based on the type of business you are. So there's going to be a retail hospitality multiplier, which, if you qualify for that, you have a lower multiplier. Again, it's still going to be done on the rateable value, which is there's going to be a higher one above £51,000 and a lower one below £51,000. And you're also going to have like much larger rateable values above £500,000. But what's also happened is there's been a change in the valuations on properties. So they've been revised from April 2026, and that's based on what the property would rent for April 2024. Whereas the one they're using at the moment is based on what the property would rent for in April 2021. Now, obviously, retail businesses and hospitality businesses rented for much lower amounts in the middle of the pandemic than they did in 2024. So those rateable values have all gone up. So the problem that's happened is in the budget, the Chancellor announced this new business rate scheme, which involved lower multipliers for businesses. And it sounded like good news. And there was this big package that they brought out to support them. And they made this big song and dance about it. But what also happened was there was a revaluation that means the rateable values has gone up by a lot. And what that ultimately means is that pubs, for example, are going to end up paying a lot more. It's capped in the first year at a maximum of 15%, but then in the second year, it could be 48%. On average, it's going to be 48% more. And in the third year, pubs are going to be paying on average 75% more in business rates.
Wow, Simon, that is huge. And I understand that at the end of March, they had that COVID relief package, didn't they, of 40%? And that is ending. It started at 75%, I think,
Yeah,
straight after the pandemic, and that is disappearing.
so that's the other really important thing to note. Pubs have been benefiting from this 40% discount on their total rates bill. And actually, until April, the start of this tax year, that was actually 75%. So they're going to see a massive jump from where they were to where they will be at the same time as all of their other costs have gone up. I ran the numbers actually for my local pub, okay, which it's April 2023 rateable value was £29,000. Its April 2026 rateable value will be £38,500. So when you take into account the fact that the 29,000 was the multiplier was 49.9p, that would have given annual business rates of £14,471. But they have been getting a 40% discount on that. So that takes it down to 8,683. Under the new system, their bill would be £14,707. So that would be £6,024 more. So when landlords are saying we're getting totally screwed by this, those are the numbers. That's why they're saying it.
And also, Lee, it's been, I mean, generally it's a bit of a rough time for pubs. Of course, they had the national insurance rates go up last year. Energy bills are still high, costs are still high generally. Consumer habits are changing. Apparently, Gen Z are all drinking green juices now. It's a tough time. The price of a pint, as you mentioned the other day, is well over a fiver.
Yeah, it's a tough time for pubs, Georgia. I really do fear. I fear for the hospitality industry in general, rising costs all coming from all over the shop. And actually, I wrote about this just before Christmas. I went and visited the town that I grew up in. Hadn't been there for quite a long time. I had quite a few pubs there. Half of them had closed down, which was quite a sad sight to see. A couple of them had been turned into flats. One of them apparently had been turned into a sort of bedsit, a sort of halfway house. It was quite depressing to see. But you're right, shifting habits. People don't typically, depending on where you are and who you are, aren't going to the pub as much. And it's making it difficult. And it is a little bit, feels a little bit like survival of the fittest. And this is just like another nail being hit into them. There were some figures that were being bandied about before Christmas about what these changes were going to do, to the pub industry, and basically suggesting that bills for the average pub was going up, were going to be going up 65%. I mean, that's an incredible amount to kind of stomach. With all of the pressures that you've just mentioned, one thing that could another row that could be brewing off of the back of all of this though is the fact that this sounds like what they're doing is going to be pub specific, but you ask any small or local business, they're also in a similar boat, and is it fair that we're just focusing on one bit of the industry because perhaps some Labour MPs and councillors were a bit upset that they couldn't get into the pub over Christmas because they weren't welcome there. I think we've all seen those stickers that went up, basically banning them from the pub. And it just feels like one of those things where I think that some backbenchers and other people probably warned about potential changes in what pubs do for the local community and what a hospitality industry means for this country. And they are just being clobbered by higher bills. And then, households are not to tie everyone with the same brush, but struggling to make ends meet. And you're right, we've had some mixed retail kind of results this week. Associated British Foods, which is Primark owner, was warning that, people aren't spending as much. Greggs warning that people weren't spending as much. Tesco boss, Sainsbury's boss saying people are tightening their belts. It's kind of difficult to keep these pubs going, and it feels like it could have been avoided. And now here we are, another U-turn, and this one's a very quick U-turn after the budget. I mean, Rachel Reeves said that she almost didn't realise that this is what would happen to pubs because it was a bit of a devil in the
Who
details
is
back in
doing their
last
numbers?
budget.
But Lee, I mean, you mentioned it there. It's not just pubs, yet this looks to be a pub-specific package. And you've got plenty of small businesses, and we haven't even mentioned online and Amazon that will be looking over there and thinking, hang on a minute, tax them, not us.
As I said, there was a quote here from Andrew Goodacre, who's the chief executive of the retail British Independent Retailers Association, and he said it's an absolute scandal if it's just pubs. Small retailers face exactly the same challenges. If they just want shops to waste away and die, they are working towards it. I mean, that is a pretty punchy, powerful statement.
And even the pubs, it is, and even the pub specific package, some of the suggestions are just extending the COVID relief by a little bit longer. Look, Simon, I asked it before. Is it time the whole system was ripe for change?
Yes, it is. And broadly speaking, that's what a lot of people were saying. And Labour did actually put in their manifesto that they were going to reform the business rate system and make it better for people. And Rachel Reeves stood up in the budget and said that that was what she was doing, that she was helping small business, and in particular, that she was helping hospitality. The issue is that it then emerged very soon after the budget, as in that d later that day, the day after, that this wasn't the case at all, and that whilst she was giving with one hand, in a way, she was taking away with the other. Now, hospitality businesses did get a 5p discount on the business rate, so but they were expecting to potentially get as much as 20p, so there was an expectation that they would be dealt a better hand. But the problem is, as I said, you then had this re-rating of their rateable values combined with, as you pointed out, the removal of the COVID era discounts, which had already been cut substantially. And the problem is under normal circumstances, maybe they could take this one on the chin because they have put a support package in place. They have capped out or hit them in year one, but it's going to hit them really hard in year two, and it's going to hit them very hard in year three. But these businesses are already massively suffering from very high costs. wages are a larger part of their costs than other businesses, and they have more people on the minimum wage. So the rising minimum wage is a problem. Employer national insurance is a problem. But then they're also dealing with, food inflation. They've got other taxes as well that they're dealing with, and other costs that they're dealing with. They've got other inflation going on. You can only charge people so much more, for food or beer, the customers, before they stop coming. But energy costs is something that they've been dealing with for the last 5 years. Like, energy costs have doubled. And the problem is that although this feels like a relatively swift U-turn by this government, by its standards of leaving stuff to fester, such as, winter fuel payments, etc., actually they left it way too long. We were writing about this the day after, okay? Big shout out to one of our business reporters, Emily Hawkins, who'd been on this from day one, right? Okay, and they've left it. What are we? How long are we from the budget now? 6 weeks. It's got to the point where pubs are banning Labour MPs and talking about going on a strike, a pub strike in January. Hey, I mean, that's really going to resonate. But it's there's an example of something we talked about in the end of year podcast is the not listening. They didn't listen before the budget. It looks like this was rushed. It looks like it wasn't done properly. And you can get away with doing that once, but you can't get away with continually doing that. And this is not the first time it's looked like something has been rushed and not thought out properly. But then you've got to listen. And the problem is they just didn't listen. They just went, no, we gave you a good deal. They just stuck to the party line. And the party line wasn't the case. It wasn't true. They hadn't given them a good deal. There was genuinely a problem. They could have nipped this in the bud in the week after the budget, and then it wouldn't have been anywhere near as damaging as it has been. And the damage isn't just what's been done with the uncertainty and the problem and everything over the last 6 weeks. The damage is also when you've got pubs closing down, as you do at the moment, because people are saying it is not worth me doing it anymore. And this is not entirely the government's fault and the fault of inflation. Some of this is down to the big pub companies and the way pubs operate in this country, and the way big pub companies are unwilling to budge on what they're charging their own tenants and the people leasing their pubs. And therefore, they're not taking into account the fact that the market has changed and that people are making wafer thin margins. And some of these people who are making wafer thin margins or losing money are saying, I'm walking away from this. But the big problem is what this is damaging is the chance of somebody else stepping in and taking on that pub. Because if you were a wannabe landlord or a successful landlord at the moment, a publican who's, and you wouldn't think, do you know what? That pub's come up in my local area. I'm going to try and take that one on because I reckon I could do well there. You just go, I am not signing up to any more of this. And that, I think, is the real problem that we've got going on here. And yeah, they've just like totally missed the opportunity to help out a sector. The whole thing has backfired really badly. And then, as Lee pointed out, it's now spreading. You've got retail going, well, hang on a minute. What about us? I mean, some of the hardest hit by this is hotels. We're not talking about hotels at the moment, but hotels apparently are going to get absolutely hammered on the business rates. And yeah, so I think we do need to, totally overhaul the system. There's even people saying, well, maybe pubs just shouldn't pay business rates. Now, that sounds quite dramatic, but maybe we do need to think of something like totally radical. I think what we need to do is we need to think about what we want and where we want to get to and what we value. And are independent retailers important? Are independent restaurants important? Are pubs important? Are independent businesses important? Do we want to back small business and not just fall into this sort of, corporate hegemony of like everything being the same kind of thing? And if we do, then maybe we do need to come up with some policies that do give small independent businesses genuinely a much better deal and a leg up because they are going up against corporations that make billions of pounds a year.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan for our weekly Investing Explained feature. A man so dedicated to helping you understand your finances that he is recording from a camper van because he has no power, no Wi-Fi or anything at his home and has decamped somewhere else. Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Simon.
Well, we've got a question here from a listener. I would like to start investing this year. How much do I need to get started and what is an easy way to do it?
There are a great many investment options and that can seem really confusing, but it doesn't have to be complex. Using an investment platform such as Charles Stanley Direct, I would highlight two simple options to get started. Firstly, a global tracker fund or global ETF or exchange traded fund, and these invest your money across the globe in different share markets. A big portion of that is the US because of its size, but you do get the instant diversification of investing in lots and lots of different companies in a single investment. The second simple option is a multi-asset fund, which, as the name suggests, invests across different asset types, not just shares. Depending on the fund, there could be bonds, which tend to offer something different to the share markets, as well as other areas such as property assets or alternative investments such as gold. And the idea with these funds is that you're not taking as much risk as a pure share market fund, such as Global Tracker, as each component performs differently, so you get a smoother ride. However, multi-asset funds do vary in terms of how much risk they take, so you need to be careful to select the right one for your needs.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. So, bad news for British pubs, bad news for small businesses, but good news for UK banks. This week, shares in Lloyds rose past 100 pence for the first time since the 2008 global financial crisis. Barclays saw their shares up more than 80% in the last year, while NatWest Group hit a 52-week high for their shares. Now, analysts at investment bank Jefferies believe valuations for UK bank shares have considerable scope, Simon, to rise further in 2026. Do we all rush out and buy? Firstly, the overall picture of the UK banking shares and sector.
I mean, I would say rush out and buy if I wasn't someone who's been sitting on some Lloyds shares since Jesus was a boy, waiting for them to go up. Oh, I was looking up the last time I wrote about holding on to them, and it was 2019. And that was after I'd written about holding on to them in 2014. And I'd written about holding on to them before then. And I've been thinking they could hit 100p for a long time. If I'd have put my money I put into Lloyds shares somewhere else, I would have made that gain a long time ago, to be perfectly honest. I hold Lloyds shares because I was a Halifax member when it demutualized. And I was just old enough to get free shares in Halifax when it went from being a building society to a bank. And then I had HBOS shares, and then HBOS collapsed in the financial crisis, had a rushed arranged marriage with Lloyds. There was a massively discounted rights issue. I thought, well, you know what? These bank shares can't get any cheaper. I might as well buy some more. So I bought some more. And then there was another massively discounted rights issue. So I bought a few more that I was allowed to buy. And then I sat on them thinking these bank shares can't possibly get any cheaper. And they possibly did get cheaper. At times, I've been not paid to wait because the dividend was cancelled after the financial crisis. I've been paid to wait because the dividend came back. I've been not paid to wait because the dividend was cancelled during COVID. I've been paid to wait again. And finally this week, I got there. My Lloyds shares hit 100p. Do you know what I should have done with them? Sold them straight away. I don't care how high they go. I should have just got rid of them. Good riddance to just not bad rubbish, but just stuff that you've held on to for too long.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're still sat there because unfortunately they're old like paper shares and so they're not in a share dealing account. So selling them would be
too much of an effort.
And also, as I explained earlier, I'm a massive procrastinator. So ask me again in 10 years. We'll see where we are.
Yeah, we'll see. So what are Jefferies saying?
Yeah, so investment bank Jefferies are saying that UK bank shares have considerable scope to rise further in 2026. It put out some research earlier this week, basically saying that bank stocks made up a big part of the FTSE's rally last year. So FTSE 100 went up a fair amount last year. The banking sector, Britain's banking sector, accounted for 40% of the rise. Amongst the rises in that, HSBC, which is very Asia-focused, it was up 318 points. We had Barclays and Lloyds, we were just talking about, also, you know, rising. Barclays was up 80% in the last year. NatWest shares hit a 52-week high on Tuesday. They've been rising. Bank shares have been rising. And I think there's quite a lot of people that are probably in a similar boat to Simon, have held on to bank shares or bought bank shares after financial crisis, thinking they can't get any cheaper than this. And they've been long waiting for banks to rise again and go higher and then cash out. But as Simon points out, it probably would have been better placed putting the money somewhere else. But when you've got old paper shares like that, there's a lot of effort to go and cash them in. But one of the big reasons why banks are soaring and doing well is higher interest rates. They are key, and they're able to charge more on loans while they've been keeping savings rates low, and it's boosted profits sharply. We've spoken about this numerous times and written about this numerous times. The amount that they're making is vast. So Jefferies has upped its price target on some of these banks. So for Barclays, it's upped its price target 19% to 560p, Lloyds by 13% to 119p, and NatWest by 14% to 720p. And there's some other smaller banks around that it's got buy recommendations on as well. Paragon Bank, OSB Group, they're targeting much higher returns than what they were previously forecasting. And the weighting that these banks now have on the FTSE 100 has risen compared to where it was at before. So the weighting at the start of 2025, so the percentage that banks made up of the FTSE 100 is 13.1%. At the start of 2026, it's at 17.3%, showing just how well they're doing.
So basically, what you're saying is interest rates mean they can charge us more when we borrow for them, and they've not giving us as much in savings rate. Brilliant, brilliant,
yeah,
lovely.
that's the gap between the two is where they're making a lot of their money, Georgie. It is, and some of the banks are obviously better than others. You only have to sweep around and look at what the savings rates are on offer at banks and compare them to what they're offering for mortgage borrowers. Including first time buyers, and if you're in the fortunate position of having 40% equity or more, the gap is big, and they're making billions of pounds from that. And that's why we always hammer home the message of it's a two-pointed argument, really. Two-pronged argument is move your money to earn more interest for yourself, but also move your money so you're not just letting big banks cream massive profits, because why should we?
Absolutely right. Well, actually, why should we? Simon, is there any link to UK banks doing well and the UK economy doing well?
There is quite a strong link between the UK economy and UK banks. They're very connected to the consumer economy, but it depends which bank you're talking about. Lloyds and NatWest, much more directly connected to the consumer economy. Some of the smaller banks as well. Some of the mega banks like Barclays and HSBC are much more globally focused, and investment banking plays a major part there. The thing to think about with bank shares as well is also that sentiment has changed or is changing on them. Banks have been unloved since the financial crisis. Banks look very different to how they did after the financial crisis, and they look very different to how they did before the financial crisis, both in terms of their balance sheets, their finances, but also the way that they make money. So they don't make the kind of money they made in the mad years before the financial crisis, but they're also much more robust businesses. And over the past year, investors have started to look at banks much more favorably, certainly in the UK, but also in the US. The question is that something that's run its course, or is that something that's going to continue? Now, arguably, probably your average investor is pretty anti-bank. But if they keep seeing bank shares going up, they might become more pro-bank and more interested in bank shares. I certainly know from the past that investors were at one point very, very interested in bank shares, and that was when bank shares were going up a lot. It's funny how people get interested in shares that are going up a lot, isn't it? At that point, you're starting to trade sentiment, not fundamentals. So you need to be a little bit careful about what you're doing. But that could potentially mean that the tailwind behind bank shares does continue.
All right, then. Lee, I'm going to stick with banks for a short while because we know banks have plenty of cash because they're splashing it about to get us to join them. There's some hefty switching bonuses being offered. Lloyds, HSBC, tell us about them.
Yeah, I'll quickly rattle through this. So Lloyds has come out with a £250 current account switching offer that runs until early February. You'll need to use the official current account switching service through the app online to get this. It's for its Club Lloyds account. Club Lloyds has a £5 monthly fee, but it's refunded each month you pay in £2,000 or more. The idea of that being that you're going to use this as your main account that you get your salary paid into and not just switch a secondary account to it and milk that £250. The switching bonus. The account has no fees on debit cards spent abroad, and it comes with either Disney subscription, cinema tickets, coffee club and gourmet society membership, or an annual magazine subscription. The £250 switch also includes its silver and platinum Club Lloyds. Silver is £11.50 a month. Platinum is £22.50 a month. Both of those are reduced by £5 a month if that £2,000 is paid in. Essentially, silver is the same as Club Lloyds. It's £5 off for it. It's set you get European family travel insurance, AA breakdown cover, and mobile phone insurance. Platinum is the same, but with worldwide travel insurance. It does offer some good rates. So mortgage rates that Club Lloyds are offering at the moment are amongst the best. So if you are a Club Lloyds customer, you will have access to them. It also has a very good regular saver, which is 6.25%. The reason why it's good is the fact that you could put up to £400 a month in it, which is quite generous for a regular saver. It also offers interest on balances between 1 and 4 grand, which is 1.5%, but it's dropping to 0.75 at the end of March. And for balances between 4 and 5 grand, get 3%. It's a better deal, a better cash carrot than what's on offer from elsewhere. Santander have got £200 offer, and Nationwide First Direct are offering £175. I think the reason Lloyds has gone 250 on this is that we're getting a bit of bank switching fatigue. I think that people are, £150 ain't cutting it anymore. £175 kind of cutting it a little bit. £200, that sounds good. £250, well, yeah, okay. Now we're getting into real chunky amounts of money. The payment's meant to come within 30 days of switching. The reason that banks do this is, of course, they want your custom. They want to cross-sell you other products. They want to make money from you. Go back to the conversation we just had 5 minutes ago. The other one that's interesting, actually, and I think we touched on this maybe in the summer, there's been a bit of a battle for wealthier customers between banks. I always think of banking and current accounts in sort of three tiers, right? You've got your usual regular folk like us, 95% of the population, probably 90-95% of the population, with just your run-of-the-mill current accounts that you can go and open. Then there's a little slither above that, another tier, which are these premier bank accounts that some of the big boys offer. And then you've got your top tier, 0.1% of people, your coots and that kind of thing. You've got to be a millionaire to get. This is a kind of middle ground that I'm about to talk about here. So HSBC is offering £750 to become a premier bank customer. Now, to be a premier bank customer, you need to have at least £100,000 in an account, either in savings or in investments. That's a big amount of money. So you'll get £250,000 if you're earning £100,000 or more in the salary, according to HSBC in this deal, and you'll get another £500 if you transfer £100,000 or more into a savings account or an investment account. That's a big leap. When you think about the savings rates that are on offer at HSBC, because it's premier savings rates. You might think, well, this is going to unlock some absolutely incredible savings rates. It does not. The premier savings rates are absolute trash. So do not move thinking you're going to get a better savings rate because you're a premier customer. Absolutely rubbish. You can get an online bonus saver with HSBC at 3.5%, but you don't actually need to be a premier customer to get that. So it's a massive decision to make. But Lloyds launched a premier account last year. Barclays has got one. If you are someone that does have £100,000 or more, it is worth having a look around at these bank accounts because they do offer you other little perks and bits and bobs as well. So for the HSBC one, for example, you get worldwide family travel insurance. Could be well worth it, if you're someone that travels abroad quite a lot. Other than that, I would have a real serious think about that. The HSBC Premier Savings interest rate, 1.8% on balances of £100,000 plus. I mean,
You're not a fan of that, Lee?
that does not feel very premier to me, Georgie Frost. That does not
No.
feel very premium product. No, that feels like a trap. That feels like nonsense. You aren't treating me as a kind of premier
As a
customer.
premier person.
Yeah, offering me rubbish like that, if I'm being honest.
I would ask myself the question, why does HSBC want to give me £750 for opening a bank account? Is it because HSBC has suddenly developed a New Year's streak of altruism? Or is it because HSBC thinks it can make more than £750 off of me? Now, I think it's probably option B. I'm not saying that this isn't a good deal. I think that you could potentially make this a good deal for yourself because ultimately they'll give you £750. But you need to structure this in a way that it is a good deal for you, not for HSBC. So you need to make sure that you make the most of it and you use all the bells and whistles that you possibly can and that you will benefit from it. And then you incur minimal costs elsewhere. Now, one of the reasons why HSBC wants to pay you £750 is because it can then try and sell you other stuff as well. It might not just be making money out of you on the bank account, probably isn't, but it can try and sell you its other products. I would advise everyone to shop around for the best possible products from any possible provider whenever they're doing anything. If you do that, then maybe the HSBC deal is a really good one. And the same goes for any of these bank account offers where they're offering to pay you money to join. I would ask myself the question, why are they doing this? And then make it work for me, not for them.
All right. Finally, as temperatures drop, energy bills set to rise as we desperately try to keep warm, but not for tens of thousands of people who live in so-called zero bills homes. These households are so well equipped with energy efficiency measures, they don't need to pay a penny for gas or electricity, even in extreme weather. It sounds ideal, doesn't it? Paying a penny for your gas and electricity. But how do you create a zero bill home? And I suppose importantly, how much will it cost you to do so? So therefore, how long will it take you to recoup that money and start actually kind of paying zero bills?
Okay, zero bills house, the latest buzz term, I would say, that's been floating around and been everywhere. And there was this whole rumor about if you've got a traditional gas boiler, you're going to be charged a new levy under Ed Miliband. Apparently, they've denied this, but you can see how something like this could unfold. It's all in a push to try and get more households to have heat pumps, solar panels, and battery storage in order to basically be in more in control of your bill. So obviously, it was not that long ago when the energy crisis erupted. We saw our energy bills go through the absolute roof, and a lot was kind of made of Britain's energy security and how, where our gas is coming from, our reliance on gas, and how our energy is produced, and do we have enough resources to keep all the lights on is essentially what it comes down to. So what the government wants to do, and I don't think this is a bad idea whatsoever really, is encourage more uptake, especially on something like solar panels. But again, solar panels is expensive, and a really expensive element to that is battery storage. And having battery storage is a pretty crucial element of having solar panels in order to completely benefit and keep them as efficient as possible. Now, we crunched some figures on this. Homes come in all shapes and sizes, of course. But as a rule of thumb, we discovered that households that install a heat pump, solar panels, and battery have to wait around about 20 years before they're better off due to astronomical upfront costs. Now, that's a real rule of thumb. It will be different for different homes, and a lot of it will depend on whether you qualify for certain grants. And there's talk around new grants inbound for, us being able to improve the energy efficiency of our home. One of the big companies that are leading this trend is Octopus Energy. It's spoken a lot about zero bills and its zero bills tariff, which launched in 2022. Under the scheme, customers living in homes equipped with green technology are guaranteed to face no energy bills for a minimum of 5 years if you qualify for that. And it's aiming to deliver 100,000 zero bills homes by 2030. However, a lot of our housing stock is old, it's poorly insulated, and it's going to be very difficult to adapt those types of home into one that's going to be zero bills. More modern homes, you've got a better chance, and new builds are being built in a way in which, rightly, we are thinking about how energy efficient they are and keep trying to keep bills down as small as possible, so we're not in the same situation in which we are facing £3,000-£4,000 annual bills, spiking bills that came very quickly and hit people very hard. And I think that's not a bad thing. To do, but you start looking at the figures on some of this. Gas boilers are popular for a reason. They work well. The central heating aspect of it, on the whole, works well for most homes. But it's how we get the gas and where it comes from that the issue is. And then you look at the figures around installing a heat pump, and I think a lot of people are against heat pumps. They're worried about the noise. They're worried about the size. They're worried about the upheaval it might take within
Quality of
the home.
heating, I've heard.
The quality of heating, all of these things, and a heat pump typically costs 11 grand, but you
Oof.
can get a £7,500 rebate via the government's boiler upgrade scheme, taking the cost of about 3.5 grand. Solar back panels and batteries set you back £8,123 on average. Again, that varies. If you are interested in doing it, the first port of call I would make is your energy supplier to find out whether they can help you do this, help you achieve this, what helps on offer, and a lot of them are helpful in doing this and kind of unlocking your home's potential to make it more energy efficient. I think it's re unrealistic to think that all the homes in Britain can become zero bills homes. I think it's just an impossible task. But the more we can do to reduce that outlay, the better. And surely, as time goes on, technology improves. The cost of certain equipment and this technology reduces. And I know, again, I know Octopus has been a massive advocate in this area, attempting to create things that make it easier and cheaper for us to do this around the home. But for example, before you plow into solar panels, I would ask neighbours who've got solar panels, how do they work, how much are they saving you, etc., etc. Look at where they could potentially go best on your house. Obviously, a south-facing garden is probably the ideal place to put your solar panels. But I would just speak to people that have experience in it and see if they can get you to talk you into it, rather than just going from a viewpoint of, I ain't doing that. That sounds expensive, etc., etc. I would have a real kind of chat with people that are in the know, that have had this done, how it works, and whether it's a worthwhile endeavour. And I'd watch this space because I think the government is kind of working towards more grants and getting the ball rolling into head in hands moment. More grants. Get ready for a bombardment of flyers through the letterbox from solar panel installers, etc. But it's an interesting concept, Georgina, and I think that as I say, anything that we can do to reduce our energy bills, if that means a 20% reduction on your bills or 50% reduction on your bills, and it calculates with the outlay, working out how many years that's going to pay for itself, it puts you in a quite a good position to make a decision whether it's worth it or not.
Yeah, it just seems to be that you probably won't reap the benefits if it takes quite so long. However, we might get to a stage where eventually the houses that you buy will start paying for themselves. You never know. Simon, stat of the week.
£1 million. That is the amount that Ryanair boss Michael O'Leary says senior politicians should be paid in order to solve, I quote, a fundamental problem with the talent in politics. In an interview with the FT, the Ryanair boss said, I think we need to reward our politicians much better. But that's political suicide to say so. So he said it instead, so that politicians don't have to do it. He said, if you're a prime minister or a cabinet minister, you should be paid £1 million a year. Interesting thought.
No,
Interesting thought,
politically,
though.
it's not going to work, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea to pay them all. The only problem is it would sort of imply that every person that gets paid £1 million plus does a really good job. And I'll be honest with you, Simon, we've discussed on this podcast plenty of people who don't.
I mean, the actual cost of this on an annual basis compared to the amount of money that we spend as a country would be minimal. So you could make it that they didn't accrue any of their very good pension off the back of their £1 million a year. I mean, how many people are we talking about here? 12? Is it, you wouldn't need to go long more than 12, would you? And maybe the cabinet might be bigger than that. I don't know. But you could pay like the top 10 or 12 people £1 million a year. It'd be only £10 or £12 million a year. I mean, that's a lot of money to you or me. It's not a lot of money to a country that spends in the billions regularly.
Yeah.
Is it? Actually, the cost of it would be relatively minimal. Who knows? I mean, it could be like,
Right.
maybe they're like, could be like football managers. They're there for a fixed contract. Actually, don't make them like
We'd
football
bin
managers.
them really
You would just
early.
spend loads of money sacking them, wouldn't we? Sorry,
Exactly.
I'm going to retract the last statement I made, which was
Terrible idea,
completely
Simon.
stupid. And then we'd fall into a position where we were poaching France's defense minister or Germany's housing minister or something like that. Yeah, scrap
Just getting
that.
Sam
Don't make.
Allardyce in for the end of the season.
Don't. He's running Venezuela, Georgie. He's running
No,
Venezuela.
you saw that same meme. All
Anyway,
right,
don't
that
make it
is
like football
it.
managers, but maybe do pay them £1 million a year.
All right, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions, team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.